Welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, the RNIB's technology show for blind and partially sighted people. See technology differently.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Tech Talk. This week, we're not joined by our usual guests, Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet, Tim Schwartz from LifeAfterBlindness.com, or even Emails Andy. This week, instead, we are joined by two special guests, Sightless Combat and Ian Hamilton, both blind gamers, and they're here this week to talk to me about the world of accessible gaming in 2020. What games are accessible to us? What platforms are accessible to us, and what is the future for gaming, and are we included in that when it comes to, say, virtual reality or even smart speaker gaming? We'll have a bit of a laugh about that coming up. Also, I'll be joined by Stephen Davidson from RNIB's Technology for Life team. He's here to tell us all about a new book that is out that will help all of us understand the many features that exist within iOS 14, not just the accessibility ones, but in fact all the features that are available. He is a blind Canadian, and he's written this book. Stephen Davidson wants to pick up on that for our Technology for Life feature today. So that's what's coming up. Oh, hang on. I think I've got a voicemail. Let me just check.
You have one unheard message. First unheard message.
Hi, Stephen. It's Robin just calling in with a quick request. Could you please let the listeners know that on the 10th of November is another AbilityNet Accessibility Insights session. It's with Christopher Patno. He's the top accessibility guy at Google. So if people are interested and would like to register to listen or get the recording afterwards, please could they go to www.abilitynet.org.uk/insights-google. Thanks, Stephen. Bye.
End of message.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. Well, good to know that's happening. Of course, you can check out everything that Robin does by following him on Twitter at USA Today, the number 2, USA Today. We'll hear more from Robin next week on the show, as we will Tim and Emails Andy as well. But right now to our hot topic of this week's show, and that is accessible gaming. And we have got some real stars in this world on the show for you this week. Two blind gamers who know their stuff. Their credentials speak for themselves. And that is exactly what I'm going to let them do. I'm going to let them introduce themselves to you. So guys, if you wouldn't mind.
Yep, so hi everyone, I am Sightless Combat. Most people just shorten it to Sightless or SK, but I'm an accessibility consultant and gamer without sight. And when I say I am a gamer without sight, I mean literally just that. I have no sight whatsoever. And I have been gaming for a number of years, but have recently been able to be involved in a fair few interesting projects, including recently doing audio description for a Ubisoft trailer. But I do reviews, I do streams, I do YouTube videos, all sorts of things, and I also write other pieces for my website as well.
And I'm Ian Hamilton. I'm an accessibility specialist. My background before that was in designing UX across games and across websites, and a couple of bits of pieces in other industries as well. I gradually moved across into accessibility over the years, and now it is all that I do. So my time is split between advocacy and awareness raising, trying to educate people about what accessibility is and why it's important, and lobbying for change and all that kind of stuff. And the other bit of my time is on consultancy, so working directly with studios and other companies, organisations around the games industry to try and raise the bar for inclusion of people with all kinds of disabilities.
Great to have you both here. This is a topic that is starting to, I think, fair to say, you know, get my interest up, because I'm not a gamer by any stretch of the imagination. So you might think, well, why have they asked him to do this interview? Well, I think actually that's quite important, because I think it's important we come to this from the point of view of people who maybe aren't playing games at the moment. Those of us who are blind or partially sighted, who are sort of interested, keen, want to get involved, but a bit nervous about it, because you think, you know, how much money am I going to spend on a console, and then realise that most of the games aren't accessible to me. I think to start with a kind of broad question, and Ian, I'll come to you first on this. You know, where are we in regards to accessibility for blind and partially sighted people playing games on consoles in 2020?
So with consoles, it's not anything remotely like where it needs to be. It's not an equitable experience. we're only really just starting to see the first couple of examples of games that have reasonably accessible gameplay and also accessible menus and interfaces as well. So there have been a few nice examples in the past of games that are doing either or. So games like fighting games, which have pretty accessible base gameplay just by default, but getting through the menus is a case of like hacking around with OCR in your screen reader or relying on memorizing from menu guides and that kind of stuff. Or the other way around, games which are now starting to include text-to-speech or either internal text-to-speech or compatibility with screen readers for their menus, but the gameplay isn't accessible, at least not without a lot of work. That is changing. If you were to go back like 5-6 years ago, there would be none of those things. You wouldn't have games with text-to-speech. You wouldn't have games with particularly accessible gameplay. So it's heading in the right direction. Consoles are probably the furthest behind because there's a lot less kind of like small homegrown efforts like there has been for decades now on PC and also mobile as well. There's a ton of accessible, fully blind accessible games on mobile as well. I think something to take from that, though, is even though those other platforms are further ahead, that means that there is actually a ton of good learning material that that developers can look at now. Now that developers are starting to have a real mainstream developers starting to have real interest in blind accessibility, there's actually already a wealth of good stuff that's already out there they can learn from. A lot of stuff which has been developed directly by blind game developers as well.
Eski, where do you stand on that?
I think I'm in the same position pretty much as what Ian's just said. Consoles, I'll cover the sort of console side of things. About 5 years ago, Sony announced that the PlayStation, well, it wasn't announced so much as revealed in a leak for a beta, from what I remember, that the PlayStation 4 would have text-to-speech for the interface. We weren't sure what degree that was going to be to, but when it did come out as a feature that people could use, it was discovered to be locked via hardware and via sort of settings and things, which was very disappointing because a large number of people seemingly had bought PlayStation 4s under the impression that they could play those without needing any sighted assistance. They could navigate the menus without needing that assistance, when in fact, if they were outside the US, they couldn't do that, which is a real shame. Unfortunately, that's still the case, but the Xbox One has resolved that issue from the Microsoft side of things by allowing for the interface pretty much regardless of where you are in the world to be read, as long as your settings are indicating you're in the right region where the feature is supported that allows you to use that being Narrator for Xbox One. But in terms of games, as Ian rightly said, there are a few examples of where games have either really accessible gameplay and no sort of interface accessibility, or the other way around, where the interface is fully accessible and the gameplay leaves a lot to be desired. Gears 5, as much as it's lauded for its accessibility efforts, you know, that doesn't have, unfortunately, the level of gameplay accessibility that is needed for most of the experience to be playable. Whereas something like, I don't know, Minecraft Dungeons is very nearly there in most aspects, but only has limited accessibility in certain places that make it problematic without getting sighted assistance. But Last of Us Part 2 is pretty much the pinnacle of game accessibility at the moment, and that's the key thing I want to stress at the moment, as in, you know, there are efforts going on currently that will hopefully eclipse that, and hopefully those efforts don't take long to materialize. That will be very interesting to see, and we'll come on to, of course, the console side of things later, I don't doubt.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you bring up The Last of Us Part 2, and that's the one that I want to focus on mainly here, because what I felt was, as someone who isn't a gamer, I felt this was finally a game that I could actually, you know, play. Simple as that, yes. You know, actually play this thing. And there have been a lot of issues around it as well. There have been conversations around the types of description that's there, how much information is given. Clearly, it's maybe not 100% there, but it's certainly, you know, considerably further forward than we've had games in the past, it would appear, from what I know of gaming. And, you know, I think for someone coming to this new, it's a good time. You know, it's a good game to play, a good game to try. Has that been your experience, SK?
I would say that's true. I mean, I've been playing video games for a lot longer than that, so I'm aware of how, you know, most of the mechanics work, and the game teaches you pretty well as you play through it. I will point out as well that I actually earned the Platinum Trophy. So in a lot of PlayStation 4 and Xbox One games, you get these achievements and or trophies or, you know, whatever the platform calls those, where, for completing certain objectives. So for completing the story, for gaining all of the collectibles, etc., you can earn these sort of marks of accomplishment, as it were. And the Platinum is when you obtain all of those various ones. And I only needed Sighted Assistance to obtain the collectibles I was missing, but they were missing mostly at that point due to a lack of accessibility in certain areas of the game, which, as far as I'm aware, has been tightened up in a very recent patch. So there is a possibility that a player could now go through the game and collect everything and not need any assistance at all. But to be able to say that I've managed to get a Platinum Trophy in the first place is a great thing to be able to tie to a game like this. And I think if a person was to buy a system for this game specifically, that would be a very good start to, you know, if they wanted to see what accessible gaming could be like, that wouldn't be a bad place to start. But then it's a question of, what do they then do going forward? Because of course there are a lack of games that are accessible, you know, to complement it or to give other genres, you know, a chance to sort of be experienced. So there's a whole other question there, I think, of, you know, what you do next after you've put several, you know, hundreds of hours or whatever into Last of Us 2.
It's a lot of money to spend to just play one game.
And that's what a lot of people have said to me. I'm aware of one individual who specifically bought a PS4 Pro, the Last of Us 2 edition, after I'd said, you know, this game is amazing. I'd highly recommend you try it. They were kind of thinking about it anyway. And then they watched me play it on a stream and they were like, oh my God, this is absolutely phenomenal. So they just went out and bought the system and they've had an absolutely brilliant time with it. So there are people who are willing to go the extra mile and buy consoles, as we saw 5 years ago as well with the PS4's text-to-speech announcement. But, you know, again, it begs the question of, if the consoles have accessibility issues at a platform level for whatever reason, then, you know, where do gamers go from there if they want to play these games and still have an optimal experience?
So, Ian, from your point of view, are you a Platinum Trophy winner on Last of Us Part 2?
No, I have a very small child, so I have to get through the game.
No chance.
Let alone on Platinum.
Yeah. But, I mean, what's your experience been of the game?
The experience that really stands out for me is the impact that it has had on the rest of the industry. And we already saw this with their previous game. Their previous game was Uncharted 4. And when Uncharted 4 launched, it launched with what by today's standards is quite a small set of accessibility features, things that are now pretty much expected from big name games, things like being able to, instead of hammer a button repeatedly, being able to hold that down instead. Those kind of things are kind of expected now a few years later, but at the time they really weren't. And the reason why they're expected now is because of that game. Because when, you know, a really big name game like that comes out, it educates people as to what's possible, it shifts consumer expectations, and it also gives developers something that they can actually look at and play with. You know, the accessibility thing is no longer theoretical, you can actually see it's there and it works, and you can quite easily imagine how that might apply to your own game mechanics. So when that came out, that was they just about managed to squeeze in a few things late in development, and when they did that, their reaction was exactly the same as it is with all developers in that situation, which is, oh my God, if only we'd have thought about this from early in development, we could have done so much more. And at that time, they were in the early stages of development on Last of Us 2. So they were able to consider accessibility from early on and consider blind accessibility from early on, which is really, really key. So it took them a couple of years to get to the point that it was at launch. So because of that, even though the efforts that's made towards blind accessibility are having a huge influence on other developers, because this stuff takes time. You know, it's really going to be a couple of years before the full impact of how this game's influenced other studios is going to be felt. But it really has influenced people in a big way. And the one thing in particular that I've heard a lot of developers talking about is that specific thing of like, here's something actually concrete that we can look at, that we can play with. You know, it's no longer a thing of like a developer's like, but this is like a video game. It's about visuals. How could a blind person even play a game? You know, you've actually got a concrete example of a really big, top-selling, popular game with a reasonably complicated mechanic that blind people are playing, and you can see exactly how. And you can see as well that it's not rocket science. You know, all the kind of accommodations that are in there, I don't think there is anything at all in that game that is only for people who are blind. It's all used by other players for other reasons as well. So I think that's a really powerful thing to see.
It's the same situation that we were in when we all wondered, how as blind people will we be able to use this sheet of glass now known as an iPhone? And then eventually somebody came up with an answer and we're all like, ah, okay, and it works. And then other companies were like, we can do this as well. And that's the point. It just takes one, doesn't it? It takes one to start the ball rolling. And that is The Last of Us Part 2. This game is going to go down, SK, in history, isn't it? Because it will be the game that really did ignite the fire under the developers to say, right, it's time to do this. It's time to make our games accessible.
I think that's a very interesting point, because there's other games that could have been said to have started that much earlier to a point, but in various different disciplines. So, you know, Gears 5 has had a lot of praise for its own accessibility options, and, you know, even though much less so, things like Minecraft Dungeons have been, you know, really good in terms of how much accessibility they have in their respective genres. But I think you're right with The Last of Us 2. It's all of these features in, you know, a package, as it were. So, you know, even though Gears of War 1 had a sort of pathfinding mechanic to a fashion all the way back in 2006, and the Ultimate Edition had it on its re-release, that kind of pathfinding mechanic can be used in this game in a slightly different way, granted, but, you know, that's an element that's carried forward. Things like, you know, there are other games that have used the sort of you know, recentering camera and a camera that points you towards your objective as well. I think one of the Ninja Gaiden games had it as well, but you know, so that the narrative menus, the target, the full-on sort of target lock aim assist that allows you to sort of aim for different parts of the body directly without needing any assistance, all of that has been, or most of it has been, in various games before in other forms, but this game is the first one to combine it all into a singular entity. And it's been great when I've been sort of working with studios and they will ask me, you know, what's the most accessible game now? I'm like, Last of Us 2. I don't even have to hesitate now. Yeah. But it's funny how it's now shifted, the sentiment has kind of shifted from, you know, Microsoft being the one pushing accessibility with things like the adaptive controller and, you know, all the various games that they've been putting out over the past sort of couple of years, you know, Sea of Thieves adding various accessibility options, Forza Horizon 4 adding, you know, menu narration and other things, Crackdown 3 starting off that trend of menu narration really in Microsoft titles. And then, of course, Last of Us 2 comes along and says, here's all of these other things that these other games need but don't have for whatever reason. So it's been a really interesting time for the industry to see that, almost that shift, especially when, you know, the PS4, the console that The Last of Us 2 is on, at least at present, you know, especially when that console has its own accessibility complications of its own. So it's going to be a very interesting year or two or three where we start seeing, you know, gradual shifts towards getting every game to be just as good as Last of Us 2 is, if not better, hopefully, all being well.
And there's a really nice culture as well within the industry of accessibility being something that companies can kind of reach beyond the traditional barriers that sit between different companies, and people are much more willing to have a discourse and share experience and stuff about their accessibility wins with other people from other companies. So I think there's just this kind of general recognition that because there's so much more work that needs to be done, anytime any company makes some good progress, that just benefits the entire industry. Everybody can learn from that and make their own progress as a result. And there's a really nice quote from that, actually, from the Game Accessibility Conference a couple of years ago. I think you were there, actually, Silas. It was John Knowles, who's the design director for Turn 10, who make the Forza racing games. And he said, let me see if I can remember the quote precisely. He said, it's like there is a race to build the most accessible game. And I know a thing or two about racing, and I can tell you that it's a race that everybody wins.
It was something like that, wasn't it? And it's that's reiterated again in the Super Bowl ads that Microsoft put out for the Xbox Adaptive Controller, where they said, when everybody plays, we all win. And I've been using that for, you know, to sort of tell people that essentially once you get as many players as possible so that they can play your game, then, you know, you will reap the benefits. And also as well, there's this idea of, you know, if you don't intentionally include, you unintentionally exclude. So essentially, if you don't design with blind accessibility in mind, for instance, or for gamers without sight, however you want to categorize it, you know, if you don't design with that in mind from the beginning, then you're going to have gamers in that position, you know, whether temporarily or long term or whatever, you're going to have those gamers being disgruntled and unable to participate, which is not fair, for lack of a better way of putting it. So, you know, basically, you know, design for one and design for one, include for many. Basically, that's the point. I can't remember the precise line, but it's, you know, the more people you design around in terms of, you know, disabilities and everything, and or situation, circumstance, then the more people are going to be able to enjoy your game, immerse yourself in the story, and just get involved with the social aspect of it as well. Being able to say, oh my goodness, did you see that final boss fight where this thing happened? And they're like, yes, I did, and it was really, really hard. And I was like, yes, I know. So, you know, being able to participate in all of that is absolutely fantastic. And I don't think this will be the final time we have a discussion like this, though. I think there will be games that will continue to, you know, evolve the formula and sort of improve on everything that we've seen with this title.
It's really nice that we're at this position as well. From going back to the start of the conversation, that mention about how there's more that could be done. There's discussion about exactly like how verbose the information is that's communicated through speech, that kind of stuff. The fact that we are now at a position where we can even be discussing like best practices, that we're no longer saying, oh my God, please, please just think about accessibility. We're now at the point where we can say, okay, now it's being done. How about this? How about this? Is this the best way of doing this? How can we do this in a more effective way? How can we make this a more enjoyable experience? You know, it's a nice position to be able to get to.
Yeah.
Can I ask a bit about the console accessibility? Because this is an area I'm intrigued by. Let's break it down for people. So if we're talking Xbox, we're talking PlayStation here. We've got the new PlayStation 5 coming. We've got the new Xbox range as well. How accessible out of the box are these consoles?
Yes, yeah, so it's already mentioned this a bit. Basically, there was a piece of legislation that came into effect in the USA called the CVAA, which is the snappily named 21st Century Video and Communications Accessibility Act. And basically what that did was to try and plug a few holes in existing legislation. So when stuff like the ADA came out, like in the 1990s, it has protections in there to make sure that like TV is accessible and telephone networks are accessible. But now people are watching Netflix and chatting on WhatsApp and Skype and Zoom and stuff, you know. So basically they introduced a new law to plug those holes and make sure that new digital forms of communication and video were had the same legal protections as the traditional ones. So as part of that, any digital communication, so that means voice chat, text chat, or video chat, must, by law in America, be accessible. And also any of the like menus and interface that you need to be able to find the functionality and navigate to it and use it, that has to be accessible as well. So that kicked in into gear for consoles in 2015. That was the deadline for it. So both the Xbox and the PlayStation in that year introduced some limited text-to-speech functionality covering certain areas of the menus that were related to kind of getting to the chat functionality in the consoles. And also they were both limited to just the USA alone initially so that they could meet those legal requirements. And that's expanded. It's expanded a little bit since then on the PlayStation. It covers a few more areas. So I think like the store that you buy the games from is also covered by the text-to-speech. Xbox had a bit of a head start. So basically PlayStation were building their text-to-speech system from scratch, whereas the Xbox is basically Windows. It's like a fork of Windows. It's a slightly modified version of Windows in a different box. And Windows already has Narrator built into it. So they kind of had a bit of a head start. So they've been able to expand it to cover pretty much all of the interface.
Anything and also outside of games. Sorry, I was just gonna say it covers the Xbox side of things, covers anything pretty much outside of in-game text-to-speech, because as far as I can remember, Narrator can't run at the same time as a game to do those kinds of things, at least not on the current hardware, but that might be something that changes in future, you never know.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's basically because when a game loads up, the way that, well, both the Xbox and PlayStation work is that they give the entire of the system resources over to the game. So there isn't actually like any spare memory and stuff to actually run a screen reader in. So what the Xbox has is basically like a basic text-to-speech API. So instead of like a screen reader going through and like analyzing all the interface and looking for the text comments and stuff, it's just a really simple thing of like a game can actually manage that stuff itself and send out just a basic bit of text, which can then be spoken out by the stuff at system level. So Xbox does actually have the capability for games that want to be able to have their menus voiced and send those send the text associated with those menu items out to the system to be read out in whatever voice and stuff you've set your preferences for. PlayStation doesn't have that. PlayStation just has the ability to just have like some of the menus read out. The games can't interact with it. But what is really exciting for me, and that's got really big potential to drive the change for blind accessibility, is basically the tools that game developers use to build games with are now starting to take on that burden, take on that heavy lifting of the blind accessibility work. So basically when you make a game, you're not just sat there kind of like typing out raw code from scratch. You start with basically like a scaffolding that you build your game on top of. And that scaffolding is now starting to handle reading the interface elements and passing them out to the various screen readers on different platforms. It's only in the early stages yet, but the two biggest game development frameworks, Unity and Unreal, have both been working on this. It's far along enough that the first game has now come out that uses that functionality. That was Halo Master Chief Collection. So once that kicks into gear, then it doesn't matter so much about the, for example, if you got a platform like the Nintendo Switch or PlayStation 4 that doesn't have text-to-speech stuff that developers can use, basically the framework will take care of all that. It will pass it out to systems that have got the functionality there for them to use. If not, it will just read it out using its own functionality. And the key part of that is it will be really, really easy for developers to do. It would be as easy as, the goal at least is for it to be easy as somebody making a native iOS app. Which will mean that there'll be a lot of games which, particularly games that are interface-based rather than exploring environments, you know, things like Football Manager or like Hearthstone card games and stuff, that could be mostly accessible out of the box. And if that can happen, then that would be an incredible change across the industry. Sorry, that was a wild tangent there. But
no, it's very interesting because, you know, it's given us the full background as well, which I think a lot of people don't realise, you know, how we got to here is also the other question, isn't it? And you've answered that perfectly. I think that's the point, that, you know, the rules are in place. Some would argue that the rules had to be in place. Others would say, well, should they have to be in place? I've had this argument for many years around audio description. Would it be as prevalent without legislation? Probably not, and the, you know, that comes through video on demand services. That, you know, when you look at the amount of audio description there without legislation compared to linear broadcasting, where it is, you can see that, you know, clearly there's a difference. So legislation does make a difference for sure.
I've been really pleasantly surprised by it because I've got to be honest, when like the prospect of developers being forced to do accessibility didn't really excite me. You know, people do their best work when they want to rather than when they're forced to, right? But it has just resulted in people wanting to, you know, it's basically been a bit of a door opener. So when there's been, previously there have been like individuals who've wanted to do cool accessibility stuff, but, you know, can't persuade their bosses. Now their bosses have all heard about accessibility. They're talking about it every day because of the legal stuff. And also people who are like now starting to think about accessibility because the legislation says they have to, are actually thinking, well, we're not interested in just doing this for compliance. Like, we're in game development because we want people to have great experiences. So now we've been given that little nudge that we needed. How are we going to make this a really good experience for our players? So it's been really, really nice to see, certainly compared to some other industries that that game developers have not really been interested in, like the compliance side of it. They're just taking this as kind of a bit of a call to arms, you know, to actually start thinking about making good experiences for more of their players.
But look, Ian and Silas, stay with me because I want to get into other forms of gaming as well. I want to talk about smart speakers. I want to talk about virtual reality as well. What does the future of virtual reality hold for blind people, if anything? Looking forward to getting into all of that with you guys, so do stay with me. For now, though, I want to bring in Stephen Davidson because he is from RNIB's Technology for Life team. Every week on Tech Talk Now, we hear from the team at Technology for Life, and this week is no different. And we're going to hear Stephen tell us about a new book which aims to help us all understand iOS 14 a little bit better. That is, of course, the Apple iPhone operating system.
A couple of months ago, I answered a call from a gentleman wishing to learn more about how to manage emails on his shiny new iPhone. In between learning how to send an email using Siri and how to delete unwanted messages, he was telling me all about this author named Michael Fair, who had written a guide on Apple's iOS operating system from the point of view of a voiceover user. The customer was raving about this man, so I was suitably intrigued. After the call, I did a wee bit of research. Michael Fair is a Canadian author and self-described digital do-gooder who has been working on his iOS guide for 3.5 years. His guide, Personal Power, the iOS edition, was released for free on April 27th, 2020, through his personal blog, and I can understand why the person I was working with was so enraptured by it. Described as more of a travel guide than a manual, the guide covers all aspects of navigating iOS with VoiceOver. From the layout and structure of iOS and the gestures needed to navigate, to the settings and features of Apple devices, Michael covers it all with a real understanding of how important it is for him to be able to independently access the same information and services as his sighted peers. In the introduction to his section on everyday use of iOS, he even writes, "When I got my first iPhone, I thought of it as kind of a separate device that was more capable than an ordinary phone, but still basically a phone. It started out with some included functions. I could find out what the weather was like, call, text and email contacts, record voice memos, and use a built-in calendar, for example. And all of this worked very well with VoiceOver. This was fabulous. Just the idea of being able to buy a mainstream device you've heard about on TV and radio shows and have it work out of the box for blind people was intensely thrilling to me. Even more thrilling was the prospect of being able to purchase and download many apps that everybody else used, and have them all just work. I had simply never been in a situation before where economics of scale could work so powerfully for me rather than against me. Prior to this, I had actually spent less money for the computer than I spent on the screen reader that let my computer say what happened on the screen. And then, one day in 2011, I walked out of the same store as the sighted people I passed on the street, having paid the same as they did, for a device I could use just as well as they could. It's personal insights like these, mixed with painstaking detail of how to access the multitude of features found on Apple devices, that really make the guide what it is. The rich text document I used to review this guide runs in at 250,000 words, making it a mammoth text. Though it is well structured and easily searchable, so readers can get to the topic that interests them the most. What I will say is, if you're looking for just a quick primer on how to use Apple devices with VoiceOver, there are definitely more succinct and user-friendly guides out there. But if you want a well-crafted love letter to Apple devices and how they empower their users, Michael Fair's guide has a lot to offer. Michael has released his guide for free for anyone to distribute in a variety of formats, including EPUB, accessible PDF, electronic braille, and DAISY MP3. It is also available on Bookshare. The best way to find a guide is to Google Michael Fair, and that's F-E-I-R, Personal Power iOS. This will bring you to Michael's blog, which has a link to his Dropbox, where you can download a zip file with the above formats included. Alternatively, the Apple Viz website has hosted the introduction to the guide, alongside links for the EPUB and rich text versions.
Stephen Davidson there from RNIB's Technology for Life team. So if you want to get in touch with the Technology for Life team with your questions regarding whatever tech it may be, then do get in touch with them. They will be happy to answer your questions and queries. You can call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999, or you can email helpline@rnib.org.uk. Now, we're talking gaming this week on Tech Talk, and I'm joined by Ian Hamilton and Sightless Combat. Now, guys, we've talked a lot about gaming in the sort of wider sense. I want to kind of focus in a little bit more on some other, perhaps more niche areas. I'll get to that in a moment. But first, I was thinking about this. I wonder if we should talk a little bit about charities and how charities can maybe help. So RNIB, for example, how can it help the gaming industry understand the needs of blind and partially sighted people? Ian, what's your thoughts on that?
There's a couple of different ways that charities can help. Firstly, the direct connections with the community. So as the industry starts getting more interest in accessibility, there's a growing need for the game developers to be in direct contact with their audience and learn from blind people about what exactly is needed and what people want to see and what people need, you know. So that's something that I think people who've like RNOB, who've got links with loads and loads of blind people, can play a good role in making those connections in between the audience and the developers. I think something that we've had a few conversations about is the role that kind of going the opposite direction to help educate and inform blind people about what possibilities there are from gaming. Even though they are relatively limited at the moment, that's only going to change for the better.
Yeah.
So I think that with the right knowledge and stuff, I think that organisations like RNIB could be in a powerful place to help kind of educate about some misconceptions, help showcase a bit of what's out there, even things like, is it you that I'm thinking of? You had like an early experience with like an open day with like demonstrations of like blind accessible gaming tech?
Yeah, not quite blind accessible gaming tech, but I went to a sort of taster day where I got to try an audio only game. This is going back many, many, many years. I got to try an audio-only game for the first time, and it essentially blew my mind at the time because I didn't really understand how gaming worked at all at that point in my life. But the point being, it was, you know, super immersive. It was, I mean, for what it was, yes, the game was very, very simple by today's standards, but it has still aged relatively well even now. And it was relatively immersive. You sort of went around a Wild West town. You did missions for various people. You, essentially did fetch quests. So you'd go and you'd find a thing, you'd give it to a person. But it was all in a very relatively linear sequence. And you did it all with sort of four or five keys. And even the combat was reduced to that, combat such as it was. But, you know, I think there's a misconception that audio, like, you know, they're called video games for a reason, as Ian said earlier, is a common thing I've heard before. I've heard one person said to me once, I work with blind people, they don't play video games, it's not the done thing, which I always use at conferences just to illustrate or to demonstrate how ridiculous that sentiment is, because then you see me playing fighting games and doing comparatively well. If I go on what other people say.
But is that actually because the perverse reality of that is because there are so few games out there, the blind people aren't talking about them because they aren't playing them, they're not going to spend the money on a console to go and buy, you know, one game and only experience that one game. So for that reason, the attitude could be seen by some as, well, there just isn't a community for that. But actually, that's because of the inaccessibility in some cases.
I mean, it depends who you ask. It's a very subjective topic, I would argue. There's lots of people who want to play. Say there's one game on a console that has five games on it, and that one game has accessibility. There are people who'd want to say, right, I'll buy the system anyway. I'll just play the one game I can definitely play and try the other ones. But then there are also people who say, why don't, you know, what's happening to audio-only games? Why aren't they improving? Or, you know, any of that. And there's still other people who say, you know, there should be kind of a you know, you should be able to play both. And there's all kinds of different schools of thought. But I think as the industry improves, there'll be more people sort of coming onto the side of, you know, if there are accessible mainstream games, we should be playing these and engaging with, you know, sighted peers and everybody else. It's like, you know, when Halo Infinite comes out next year, I'm going to be trying that game as early as I can and, you know, streaming content from it and everything else, writing up a review and all of that, because I want to be able to say, I hope to be able to say, this is the most accessible Halo yet, and it has all of these things involved that, you know, you can now do without needing any sighted assistance. Whether that's going to be the case or not remains to be seen, and again, that's a whole other discussion, but it's going to be interesting to see how many join me on that, you know, from, you know, just a general perspective, how many people are willing to dive in, take that leap, and just see what's possible. Because that's the thing, if you have people seeing what's possible with a title, sometimes, you know, there's games that I've not tried where people have gone in and they've said, oh, this is playable. I'm like, oh, cool, fine, I'll go and play it. And then I find that, you know, even though there's a few bugs, it might be sort of doable with a little help and a little optical character recognition. And, you know, that happens sometimes. So, you know, the more people that try these games and figure out they're playable and feedback to developers, the more feedback the developers have to work with and the more they can do to improve their games. So, you know, it's a positive cycle, really. You know, more feedback equals more improvement equals more feedback equals more improvement, etc.
We've talked a lot about console gaming, and rightly so. It's a big area for us, a huge area of development, it seems. But what about the other ways that a lot of us, you know, maybe play games, maybe on mobile, dare I even say smart speaker? I knew you would laugh when I say that. But, you know, let's be honest.
It's just a funny term. It's a funny turn of phrase. It's just like, smart speaker just doesn't...
Well, she's smart, put it this way, she's smarter than me. But
no comment.
But honestly, I think, you know, there is a huge avenue here for audio games, for sure. I mean, today, for example, I got my update to my Apple AirPods Pro, which now gives me spatial sound, and that was incredible to experience. And I think about the potential there. You know, Bose frames, although unfortunately we've lost the augmented reality part of that, of those. But, you know, again, the potential was there. So, you know, we're clearly moving towards this kind of world where audio and augmented reality, spatial sound, whatever you want to call it, is going to become, you know, a big part of our movies we watch, a big part of the audio we listen to, but also gaming as well. Ian, where are we with mobile gaming?
Mobile, for the longest time, has really been where blind gaming has been at, and largely because of the good job that Apple did in how accessibility works with app development. So if you are building a native app, so I mentioned earlier about game developers using these like scaffolding frameworks to build games on top. If you're building just a regular iPhone app, you don't use those kind of frameworks. It's pretty simple to build one. And if you build it in just the regular native way, the operating system can just pick up on all the interface elements just by default out of the box. So I think my favorite example of that was a game called Hanging with Friends. So I'm sure there's a few people listening who've heard of Words with Friends. Hanging with Friends was kind of the follow-on to that. And they built it as just like a regular iPhone app, which meant that it was like 90% there for accessibility just by default because they'd used sensible names for their buttons and stuff, you know. And they had no idea. They never even thought about blind people playing their game. The first they actually heard of it was when CNN in the USA ran a news story about a blind woman playing their game. You know, that's how easy it should be, you know, because it's a whole different question for like for a blind gamer to go to a developer and say, by the way, your game is mostly blind accessible. There's like these two unlabeled buttons here and this bit of text here that I can't access. That's a whole different kettle of fish to going to a game developer and saying, your game is completely blind accessible. Can you think about making it blind accessible? You know,
it can be very difficult to reach developers of any scale, on mobile, on console, on PC, on, you know, regardless, irrespective of platform. It can be difficult to reach developers, whether that's because of, you know, possibly a language barrier, whether that's because of, you know, time zones or just finding details mostly, or because, you know, there's just publisher details, and then you have to go through various PR individuals to get to the actual team who are working on the game. But if you can get through to a team who are working on a game, and you know, you're constructive about your feedback, that's normally a good place to start. But in terms of mobile gaming, I would disagree, but maybe that's because I don't play many mobile games myself. But that's mostly because a lot of the mobile games I'm aware of were mostly just word-based titles. So, you know, things like sort of Hanging with Friends, Words with Friends, or their sort of dice and card games, which aren't generally my preference, but that's you know, possibly mostly just me. But you know, there's you know, hundreds of thousands, you know, numerous apps on the App Store which are really interesting that I'd like to sort of join in with, you know, all these sort of mobile games. I just kept thinking of Raid Shadow Legends in my head, just rather amusingly. It was like, you know, you hear about it on YouTube all the time on these ads, or you hear about sort of PUBG Mobile, Fortnite Mobile, all of these sort of larger scale releases, you know, that I'd want to get into myself, regardless of their stances on microtransactions and all of those things, that I can't get into yet. But I'm hoping that with the developments that have been going on, that it will open up from just being word-based or text-based games, or even things like Untold RPG, which is a really interesting recent release that's got official support for VoiceOver, which is the iPhone screen reader. So it basically makes the game pretty much fully playable as far as I'm aware. You know, even releases like that, I hope it opens up from that to just expand to more and more genres, so that we have sort of parity between, you know, whatever platform you decide to game on, you should be able to play what kind of game you want to play, rather than the games that you can play, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, there's about 400 or so fully blind accessible games listed on Apple Viz for iOS, and the majority of them are exactly like, so it was saying, like card games, word games, dice games. Dice World is wildly popular. It's just like playing Yahtzee, you know. It's real basic stuff, but it's really popular because it's one of the few games out there that allows blind and sighted people to play together on a level playing field. And that means there's loads of people who are using it to like keep in touch with like relatives overseas and that kind of stuff. If those same benefits could be felt through a proper mainstream game, even something that's not too far away, something like Hearthstone, which is like a like Magic the Gathering style card battling game by the people who make World of Warcraft, if that could be blind accessible, you know, and there are games like that, like Football Manager and stuff, which are completely interface based. So once those tools from those game engines, those scaffoldings come into place, then that should make that kind of stuff more popular. Because it's not even just so much about how engaging the experience is of like a dice game versus like a complex action game or something. I think there's more to it than that. It's about societal inclusion, right? Like being able to do the same thing that like all your friends are talking about and doing, right?
Yeah, precisely. It's sorry, just to lead on from what you were saying, Ian, it's like with Halo, for instance. I've not been able to play a Halo game without sighted assistance at all, you know, regardless of the, you know, good steps forward that the Master Chief Collection has made with menu and UI narration. You know, irrespective of that, I'm still unable to play a Halo game without any assistance at all. But what I did manage to do was get a map and mode set created called Medusa with a bunch of sighted co-forgers and playtesters, and that's allowed me to then essentially, for lack of a better expression, bring people into my world and have sighted players be on the same map and, you know, with everything, with the same audio, but wearing blindfolds. So they all, you know, regardless of the level of vision, you wear a blindfold and you run around and you still have the same experience. You just have to learn how to play it slightly differently. And, you know, getting people talking about accessibility like that has been great. But with, you know, if we circle back to Last of Us 2 briefly, being able to discuss, you know, regardless of the limited understanding of the story that I have due to the lack of audio description in cutscenes and for in-game events. You know, even though that's there, I've still been able to talk about my feelings towards the story and, you know, the length of the game, the gameplay itself, you know, the scary encounters I've had when an enemy's come around a corner and I've not realized it's there until the, you know, the final possible second. You know, all of that is the same thing that other people would be talking about, regardless of whether they've got sight or not. And being able to get involved with these, you know, pop culture phenomena like pre-ordering a new console, you know, or getting involved with all the hype for the next generation of gaming is crucial to being able to, you know, socialize and be on an equal, you know, level playing field.
Okay, so if I ask about smart speakers, you won't laugh anymore, SK?
No, of course not. I've always just found the term smart speaker rather unusual.
but what about its gaming prowess? Does it have any, do you think? I mean, there are obviously audio games on there. It does make a lot of sense that blind people can enjoy that. Is it too simple an interface for you, do you think?
I don't think so. I think it's the type of experience that you go through in terms of what games you play on it that can dictate, you know, your feelings towards it. Like I've played a few trivia games on there. I've played a couple of kind of audio-based sort of adventure experiences on there, and they can be quite good. I think it mostly depends on the level of production for these kinds of things as well. You know, think of it like a text adventure game versus something like A Hero's Call, which is a full-on audio-only RPG released about 2 or 3 years ago. You know, it's the same principle, but the medium through which all the details are conveyed can make a difference. But I think, you know, smart speakers are an interesting outlet for games where, you know, you might not necessarily either have a keyboard in front of you, or you might just want to, you know, relax and, you know, not sort of bother yourself with anything other than just talking to your device of choice. And that's completely fine. I think there's definitely potential there, though, to expand the possibilities with those kinds of games as well beyond what currently exists. You know, even things like Skyrim Very Special Edition could be expanded upon beyond the sort of relatively simplistic thing that a lot of reviewers make it out to be, or the sort of novelty joke wear that it kind of ends up being categorized as on various places. But I think there's definitely potential for it. It's just a matter of, you know, as we've said, one developer doing an amazing, creating an amazing game that then other developers are like, wow, I didn't know this was possible on a smart speaker. So I think that once that happens, whatever that game is, if it's not already happened, then that will get people definitely talking about the possibilities of gaming on those kinds of devices as well in earnest.
I've not got a huge amount of time left, but I just want to ask one more question if I can to sort of round up. Ian, I'd like to ask you about the future of gaming, and SK, please come in on this as well, but I think a lot of us are looking at virtual reality as the next step for a lot of gameplay. We're seeing the new Oculus Quest 2 coming out soon, and you know, this is wireless gaming that Facebook are trying to build this you know, all-in-one headset that you can get all the experience from. You can connect it to a PC if you want, but you don't have to. Does any of this... Do we have any hope here with this? Can we use this, Ian? Is this something we can get excited about?
Yes. So this is something that I've... well, first off, I just want to say, for anyone who's worried, I don't think in for a second that the VR and AR is going to be the future of gaming. I think it will have a place in the future of gaming, but I don't think remotely that like PCs and mobile gaming and consoles and stuff are going to disappear and be replaced by VR. So anyway, that out of the way.
This is controversial. Okay, all right.
I think I kind of agree, to be honest, to a point, because there's always going to be a place for, you know, a controller-based setup or playing on a keyboard or with a mouse, you know, any of those kind of methods, even smart speakers. So, you know, all of that. So,
guys, it's been really interesting talking to you, learning a lot about gaming from, you know, wide range of different devices and how things have, you know, come to be. I think it's been really interesting. You know, for people who want to follow you guys and learn more about you, this is the point where you promote the heck out of yourselves. so SK, on you go. Where can we find you?
Okay, yeah. So you can follow me at Sightless Combat on Twitter. So SightlessKombat. And that's basically where you can find me on Twitter, on YouTube, on Twitch as well, if you follow streams on there. And you can also go to sightlesscombat.com to see my reviews and various articles and the Transcribing Games project, which essentially seeks to add audio description to video game footage. And there's also possibilities to contact me on any of those methods for potential consultancy opportunities if you happen to be a developer listening to this.
And Ian, what about you? How can we follow you online?
I'm most active on Twitter. You can reach me on there under at Ian Hamilton _. My DMs are open on there if you want to have a chat privately. If you don't do the whole Twitter thing, then you can get me by email on i_h@hotmail.com.
Ian and Eske, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Great to hear from Ian Hamilton and Sightless Combat joining me here on Tech Talk this week. Well, look, we're almost out of time. Just enough time to tell you that coming up on next week's programme, I'll be joined once again by Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet, who managed to sneak in at the top of the show with news of his upcoming talk, which is well worth listening to, I guarantee it. All of the AbilityNet talks are well worth checking out. The most recent, of course, as Robin says, with Christopher Patno from Google. Really looking forward to hearing more about that. Now, also on the show next week, of course, we'll be joined by Tim Schwartz from lifeafterblindness.com. Emails Andy's back as well. We're getting back into your emails, and we will be following up on that conversation we had on last week's show, all about Braille. Lots of you have been getting in touch. We'll get to some of your emails. There are lots to get through on that. We're also going to try and get into some other emails on other topics as well. Plus, we have news of a new product from RNIB. That's all I can tell you at the moment. But a new product is being launched by RNIB. We have all the details coming up. And Robin's here with an interview as well. And a way you can engage with the very latest artificial intelligence tech and help its development. All the details on that coming up on the show next week. Just one final reminder that you can always get in touch with the show by emailing us, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. You can find us on Twitter as well, @RNIB Radio. We're on Facebook, just search for us there. For now, though, from me, Stephen Scott, to you, thank you for listening again, and we look forward to hearing what you've got to say about this week's show and previous shows next week here on Tech Talk. Bye-bye.